From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. We'll get you updated on the news that made headlines this week around our region. And today, our panel includes Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, Don Day, the founder and editor of BoiseDev.com, Nicole Blanchard with the Idaho Statesman, and Carly Flandreau, reporter with Idaho Ed News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
All right, let's talk elections since we are 4 days away. And Logan, I want to start with some legislative races around the state because there are some fairly competitive races to keep an eye on. So let's start with District 6. For folks who are trying to figure out where that is, that's up in the Moscow-Lewiston area. So tell us about this race.
Moscow-Lewiston, that's exactly right. So District 6 in North Central Idaho covers Latah County, Lewis County, part of Nez Perce County. It's a really interesting district in that it has those two cities, Moscow and part of Lewiston within it, but it also stretches out onto the Nez Perce Reservation. And this is a district that the last several years has kind of flipped back and forth between Republicans and Democrats representing it. Of course, that calculus has changed a little bit because the boundaries are slightly different than they were prior to the redistricting round. But this is an area in Moscow-Lewiston where the current contingent, the current delegation from this district is all Republicans. But with the university up there and some of the politics around Moscow, this is an area where Democrats have a chance of perhaps flipping some seats back.
Okay. And so then, Logan, let's go next to District 15. This is in Boise. This is another race a lot of folks are watching.
Yes, this is, I think this time around, especially that Senate race is one of the most expensive legislative races that we're watching this cycle. And this is another one of those purple districts. This is one where the seats swing back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. And especially the Republicans here in Ada County have their eyes on District 15 because, like we all know, a lot of these races in Idaho are decided in the primary. That's the case for these deeply red Republican districts, as well as for those deeply blue districts around Boise. And this District 15, it kind of straddles the edge of Boise and Meridian. And so there's a lot of really red districts on the one side of it and a lot of really blue districts on the other side. And this is a place where both parties are trying to make some gains and also trying to hold on to those seats that they have there. The Republican candidates, three women, Cody Galloway, Annette Tipton, and incumbent Representative Dori Healy, are making a pretty good showing and campaigning pretty hard for those seats.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now you've got two others. There's District 26 in the Magic Valley, as well as District 29 in Pocatello. Let's start with District 26 in the Magic Valley.
Magic Valley, District 26. Yes, this is, back before redistricting, this is another one of those that was known as one of those kind of reliably blue districts. It includes Blaine County and the Wood River Valley area, so Sun Valley, Ketchum, Haley. However, it has kind of shifted a little more purple in recent years. One of the House seats is currently held by Representative Jack Nelson. And this one is also really interesting. They have a really interesting Senate race in 26. And this is Blaine, Lincoln, and Jerome counties. Ron Taylor, the incumbent Democrat, is facing Lori Likely, the Republican candidate. And Likely, she is a somewhat, I would say, moderate or more traditional Republican candidate who made it through the primary. But this district also has an independent candidate who's running to the right of Likely. This is a woman named Kayla Tate. And she has gotten some endorsements from groups affiliated with the Idaho Freedom Foundation and kind of in that camp. So it'll be really interesting to see if this independent candidate chips away votes from the Republican candidate. It could be a situation that helps the Democrats hold on to that Senate seat, which will be very important for their very small caucus of 7 members in the Senate.
Okay, and so let's wrap up with District 29 over in Pocatello. Talk to us about this race as well.
District 29 in Pocatello, another fairly blue seat that has well, I say fairly blue. It is another one of these kind of swing districts. One of the House seats is held by Representative Dustin Manwaring, who is in leadership in the Republican caucus. And the Republicans are hoping to flip that other House seat and make it pick up another House seat for them. Of course, Republicans are so dominant here, there are only so many places where they have seats they could possibly flip. And so Manwaring is a very strong candidate and has a pretty high profile as a legislator. The candidate running for the other seat, Tony Burgoyne, I am not as familiar with, but I know she has been seeing some support from other Republicans. I believe some of the House leadership were over there in Pocatello recently trying to rally some support for her. So this is another area where the Republican Party is hoping to make some inroads into Pocatello, which is a traditionally kind of Union Democrat stronghold as far as Idaho goes.
So, Carly, I want to bring you in on this as well, because you've done some reporting about District 19 and this, I'm sorry, District 29 and this race and its impacts potentially on education. So can you talk to us about what you've been looking at in regards to this race?
Sure. So this is the second time Manwaring has gone against Mary Shea, and they're both lawyers. The first time was in 2022, and Manwaring bested Shea by 644 votes. At the time, Shea was a political newcomer, still fundraising and building her campaign. She now has greater name recognition and support, including backing from the Idaho Education Association. And they flipped after supporting Manwaring in 2022. Manwaring attributes that reversal, which he called frustrating, to a key difference between the two candidates. Shea opposes all forms of private school choice, which is a controversial effort to subsidize private schooling with taxpayer dollars, while Manwaring opposes vouchers but is open to tax credits or education savings accounts if they meet certain conditions. If Manwaring wins, he could be a swing vote on private school choice. And like Logan was talking about, he's a Republican caucus leader, so he would have the power to influence intra-party discussions. But Shea could prove a hardier adversary this time. It is a district that's bluer than many, and she's campaigning alongside District 29 incumbent Democrats, Representative Nate Roberts and Senator James Ruckey.
And Carly, I think it's fair to say that school choice is going to be a big issue once again this upcoming legislative session come January.
Yep, definitely, from everything we're hearing.
Okay. So, Carly, I also want to talk about some other things that you've been working on in regards to the election. And so statewide, you reported that school districts are going to be asking local taxpayers for $244 million come Tuesday. Can you break this down for us? Because this is covering six school districts. So what are these districts? How much are they asking for?
Well, first, I want to clarify that there's a lot more than six school districts. I just kind of highlighted the six that have the biggest asks, but we have the full list on there. So altogether, voters across 27 counties will be asked to fund education measures that would go toward teacher and staff salaries, sports, extracurriculars, building maintenance, classroom supplies, and more. So Soda Springs School District has the biggest ask on the ballot. It is for a $55.2 million bond over 20 years that would go toward a new high school and upgrades to an elementary. In Coeur d'Alene, they're asking for a two-year supplemental levy for a total of $50 million. In Lakeland, they're asking for a two-year $19 million supplemental levy. Pocatello-Chubbuck is seeking a two-year $16.5 million levy. Idaho Falls is seeking a two-year $16 million levy, and Twin Falls is seeking a two-year $14.4 million levy. So as voters go to the polls to vote on these things, it's worth noting a couple things. Most districts in Idaho have levies on the books. About 79% of traditional school districts, or 91 out of 115, had a levy on the books last school year. And those levies can make up anywhere from a half a percent to 39% of a school district's budget. Also, your local taxes for schools, if approved, may be lower than advertised. That's because a bill aimed at school bond and levy property tax relief means taxpayers' actual tax rates may be lower, but districts can't include that information on the ballots, partly because that relief is not guaranteed and is subject to yearly legislative approval.
And I would just note, folks, if you live in one of these 27 counties where they're going to be asking for this, Carly did do a really in-depth story on Idaho Ed News, so you can go to that story and look at exactly what the school districts are asking for, and even how the bonds and the levies work, because sometimes, Carly, that can also be really confusing. So appreciate all this reporting.
Yeah, and I should add, supplemental levies just take a simple majority to pass, whereas a bond takes a supermajority. One last thing I wanted to add, this race is going to be really interesting because recently the March and August school election dates have been eliminated. Mm-hmm. So this is the first time some districts have had a measure on a November general election ballot. It's going to be really interesting to watch how levy measures fare statewide and what the success and failure rates indicate for schools as they navigate this new normal of halved election dates.
So Dawn, Boise Dev recently reported on the fact that St. Luke's Health System and Boise State Athletics just recently found out that they are the recipients of a significant multi-million dollar gift. So before we get into that part of it, can you start out by telling us about who Alan T. and Billy D. Noble were?
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a great question. These two folks, you may not recognize their name, although you've probably seen it if you've been to a game at the stadium on campus at Boise State. The Hall of Fame gallery on the corner is called the Alan Noble Hall of Fame. This is the same Alan Noble and his wife. They have both passed away. Billy D. Noble died in 2017 and Alan died in 2021. They were both born here in Idaho, and you know, they took a little bit of hard work and some ingenuity and literally made a fortune. Started out, Alan did, as a potato farmer. And that work on his farm in Cuna led to some innovations around irrigation. They were asked in the late 1970s to put some money in a startup that no one had ever heard of. It was this small outfit based in a dental office in Boise called Micron. And they put in $300,000 in early seed money, along with two other people, the Nicholson family and the Yonke family of Boise. Today, Micron is worth $110 billion. So I would imagine most of their stock has long but since been sold, but a really great return for $300,000. Mm-hmm. Those investments actually helped bring in J.R. Simplot. And for a time in the 80s and 90s, Alan Noble was on the Micron board along with J.R. Simplot and some others when this company was really shepherded by longtime local folks. So fast forward through a life of you know, business and grandkids and all sorts of things, and they left a significant amount of money to their heirs. And yesterday, we got an email from St. Luke's Health System about a donation, which you alluded to. Now, we don't actually really cover donations at Boise Dev, and I want to explain a little bit about why. There's a lot of them, and a lot of people doing really great work in this community. And if we were to do a story every time someone donated $100,000 or $200,000 or even $1 million, that's really all we would do. And so I saw this news release about these donations, and I'm intentionally not saying the amount yet for a reason. And we thought, gosh, this feels a little different. And so we went ahead and did a story. And what's happening here is the Noble family is donating $25 million each to St. Luke's Health System and Boise State football. So $25 million each, a total of $50 million. So if you're going to consider pitching us a donation story, I guess our threshold is $50 million.
$50 million? Okay, good to know. This is incredible though, Dawn. Yeah. I mean, really. So can you also, I mean, talk about what, I mean, I read what you posted, what Chris Roth, the CEO of St. Luke's, said. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are like life-changing gifts. I mean, and I'm not over exaggerating here.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, I can say for Boise State, they said that this is their largest ever, single donation in terms of dollars. And it's interesting. I'm going to swing back to St. Luke's, but let me tell the Boise State part first here. Cause it'll help me get to that. I texted Jeremiah Dickey, the director of athletics at Boise State, said, "What are you going to use this for?" Cause usually when somebody gives a large gift, it's earmarked towards something, right? So the Stickle families for the Stickle Sky Center or Alan Noble's previous donation for the Hall of Fame, or the Cavan and Williams families for the practice field, indoor practice field there. Like, usually it goes towards something. And Jeremiah Dickey said they don't actually have it earmarked yet. It will be for football. It's a football donation. And as he said to me, you know, they have many needs. And so we'll see. I think we might get some more specificity there. On the St. Luke side, you mentioned Chris Roth. He said he had a really interesting quote. He said, "Words of gratitude all seem insufficient to properly convey the impact this gift by the estate of the Nobles will have on Idahoans for generations to come." And then said that legacy gifts are critical to the health system. So it'll be interesting. St. Luke's is obviously in the middle of a fairly significant capital project, yeah, expanding their downtown campus and some others. So $50 million is not insignificant. I want to say one more thing. This week, Andy Scoggin, who was a longtime Albertson board member, spoke at an event, and he talked about this idea of this community rallying together and looking for its next, quote, green belt moment. And if you know the history of the Boise Valley, you know that in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, there was a lot of foresight into, hey, let's take this Boise River thing that's kind of a mess and let's have this amazing pathway. And today, as you know, you can bike, walk, or rollerblade, I suppose, from Lucky Peak all the way to Eagle, on mostly on both sides of the river. And you're not, you know, behind expensive houses or anything. You're right on the river. It was a major thing. It was controversial at the time. And Andy put forth this idea that our community should look for our next greenbelt moment to propel us into the future. Andy's on the St. Luke's Health System Board, which I think is interesting. I haven't asked him about this, but he made these comments the day before the gift was announced. And his message was for our valley to continue to thrive, we all have to look for ways to pioneer in the way that the people who lived here for thousands of years did, for the people who came here in the 1800s did, and for the people who said, let's build the Boise River Greenbelt. I think that particularly the St. Luke's gift is a way to do that. Certainly not to negate the importance of Boise State Athletics and what it does for the brand of this area, but it's big dollars, and I think that it shows a real commitment to making this place special. And I'm going to get off my rear soapbox now.
No, I totally agree with you, though, and I really appreciate just the story about the family, right? This couple, and giving, I think, voice to who they were and what they've done as well. So appreciate that story.
Yeah.
Nicole, I want to talk quickly. Can you tell us quickly about this wildfire? There was another wildfire in Southeast Boise this week. So where exactly was it?
Sure. So this was right by where the Plex fire was earlier in the summer. It is up by the Oregon Trail Reserve, kind of right alongside Idaho 21. It is, gosh, I think the fourth fire in that area in the last just couple of months. It's been hit really hard. And as we know, the Valley Fire that went out about 2 weeks ago was caused by some power equipment from Idaho Power, but the rest of these have all been human caused. And so that's it'll be interesting to see what we find out about the cause of this new fire that they're calling the Leeds Fire. It is out, and it was around 350 acres.
So, but at this point, Nicole, they don't have a cause for it yet. So we don't know if this was human caused or not.
So we know that it was human caused because it sparked in the middle of the day and there was no lightning, but we don't know, you know, was this somebody shooting an exploding target? Was this, a deliberate arson? Was it fireworks, any number of other things. So all we know is that it wasn't natural.
And there was a subdivision that was near this latest fire, correct? I mean, because that's what we saw with the Valley Fire. I mean, yeah. that was very significant for a lot of the neighborhoods in Southeast Boise.
Yeah, that's been one of the really concerning things about this series of fires is that there are homes right over in that area. This one was right next to the Sunny Ridge subdivision, which is kind of between Lucky Peak and Interstate 84. And like I mentioned, this was really, really close to where that Plex fire started. And that fire burned right up to some homes as well. We didn't see evacuations this time, But yeah, they're threatening development, which is another really concerning factor as we're getting, building further into the foothills and also seeing fires that, are starting really late in the season. This was a really unusual time to get a new wildfire spark.
Right. I mean, end of October. Absolutely. So, Carly, four school districts in Idaho will be asking voters to support multimillion-dollar supplemental levies this election day. So, where are these districts and why are they saying these levies are needed?
Yeah, so generally these asks reflect the obstacles school leaders face today, from addressing budget shortfalls to keeping students safe to ensuring competitive staff salaries and manageable class sizes. So I took a look at four of the biggest ones in the southern half of the state. And before I jump into this, I want to clarify one thing. Supplemental levies are often, but not always, two-year levies. And so the first one I'll talk about is in Twin Falls. And they might talk about their levy as a $7.2 million levy. That would be per year for 2 years, but altogether it's $14.4 million. So at EdNews, when we talk about levies, we talk about the complete total over the 2 year span. So anyway, Twin Falls is running a 2 year $14.4 million levy, and most of that's going to go to staffing. And that's generally the case with all levies. Most of them go towards staff salaries and benefits. So in this case, $8.8 million would go to staff salaries and benefits. It is an increased ask, and it's one of only six increased supplemental levy asks among the 22 on Idaho ballots. And I talked to their superintendent. He said that's because of inflation and increasing costs, expiring COVID-19 relief dollars, and then a sweeping facilities bill that was passed last session that inadvertently impacted how lottery dollars are used and created a funding gap for some districts and how they pay maintenance staff. So that's in Twin Falls. Then over in Idaho Falls, they're running a 2 year $16 million levy. Interestingly, they don't have information about this on their website. The only real way to get information is to look at a sample ballot. But most of this levy would go towards salaries. That would be $12.5 million total going to staff salaries and benefits. Over in Bonneville School District, which is in the Idaho Falls area, they're seeking a 2 year $11.6 million supplemental levy, and $11.1 million of that, so the vast majority, will go towards staffing costs. Bonneville School District leaders are keeping their levy ask the same this time around, and that's doable partly because of a slowdown in student enrollment growth, according to their superintendent. But at the same time, there's been a dramatic shift in state funding with the return to attendance-based funding. And that means the district's savings funds is diminishing to maintain the status quo. So that's likely going to mean a reduction of up to $4 million in their savings account. So what that means is trustees might have to come back to voters for an increased levy as early as next year, but for now, they're keeping it the same. Finally, over in Pocatello Chubbuck, they're seeking a 2 year $16.5 million levy, $9.5 million of which will go towards staff salaries and benefits. And an interesting thing here is their levy has been on the books for more than 60 years, but this is the first time it's been run during a general election. So we'll see if that has an impact on outcomes. And I just wanted to throw out there, if there's any North Idaho voters, you can go to Idaho Ed News for an in-depth story about levy measures in Coeur d'Alene and Lakeland. And that was written by my colleague, Emma Epperly.
Okay, appreciate all of that, Carly. Really important information as we head into Election Day. Nicole, talk to us about this latest grizzly bear encounter over in Southeast Idaho. Because this is the third one, right? Since what, June?
Since June, yeah.
So what do we
So
know about this latest one?
again, we had this is the second of the three that has been a hunter encountering a grizzly bear. It is once again over in the Idaho Falls area. This one was east of Idaho Falls around Kilgore, which is a really small unincorporated community. This person was hunting for elk. He was in a really heavily wooded area in the Caribou Targhee National Forest. And according to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, as he was making his way through that heavy timber, a female grizzly charged at him through some dense brush. And he had a hunting rifle, obviously, as he was out hunting, and did use that and shot and killed the bear. So this is the third incident where someone has shot and killed a grizzly in that area because it was either charging, or in an incident that we saw back in very early September, Two elk hunters shot and killed a bear that actually managed to knock one of them down and bite his arm. So there was an actual contact there.
Wow. Okay. Well, appreciate the latest update on this. With that said, Dawn, let's talk about the possibility of a professional soccer team, but also a stadium being built at Expo Idaho. And I have to tell you, I think we've heard about stadiums for so long here that I'm always a little bit skeptical. So
Yes, Boise Dev launched in 2016, and these are our sixth and seventh stadium projects. So, there's a couple things going on here. You mentioned one of them, which is was widely reported on, and so there's two. Just hang with me. There's your
what?
roadmap.
Oh, okay.
There's
Okay.
two. So,
Okay.
widely reported, there was an auction process that happened earlier this week for a stadium, but not a stadium, but not a stadium at Expo Idaho. So let me explain.
Okay.
The county is looking for somebody to spruce up the current grandstands and turf club at Expo Idaho. This is the LeBois Park site where horse racing was for quite a long time. The horse track would go away and be replaced with a soccer field, one of a bunch of soccer fields, but this soccer field would have grandstands next to it. The county, in its RFP request or its auction request, called it a stadium and then tried to tell us later it's not a stadium. So I don't know. You can decide if it's a stadium or not. This would be home to a group that has the rights to bring two soccer teams here, one higher division women's team and one lower division men's team, both playing in the USL related pro soccer leagues. So that'd be really exciting. And soccer has been something that has been looked at for the Treasure Valley for a number of years, as you had alluded to. There was a whole series of proposals, four or five different proposals for stadiums in Boise at the end of the last decade that finally ended with voters going to the polls and saying the city couldn't spend money on those without voter approval, and also contributed to former Mayor Dave Beter being voted out of office. So that's the first project, which everybody kind of reported. Our reporter, Margaret Carmel, who did all this work, had a hunch that there was more to the story and attended a second meeting that same day at the county where it was revealed that the company that owns the Boise Hawks are getting the green light to explore creating an urban renewal district in Garden City that would allow them to build a new stadium for the Boise Hawks just north of their current site, the Aging Memorial Stadium. That company, Greenstone Properties, and developer Chris Shane was behind the four or five different proposals in Boise for stadiums. They own the Hawks and have been looking for a way to get into a better stadium for a number of years. So this all happened in one day. Two projects coming down the tracks here. One, a new baseball stadium at Expo Idaho. Another, stadium. Now, Gemma, you were circumspect in your intro. I'm circumspect here. We've heard a lot of ideas for stadiums. There's a lot that still has to happen. I will say that the soccer project is interesting because it takes some of the existing infrastructure that was used for LeBois Park, the grandstands, the turf club building, and repurposes them into something that could be used for soccer. The leader of this, or one of the leaders of this ownership, is a gentleman by the name of David Wally. He works for Gardner Company, but this is separate from those interests. He's also one of the main partners in the Riverside Hotel development. If you've been to the Riverside Hotel in recent years, you've really seen a lot of changes under that same ownership group. The sandbar, revamping the pool, there's a new Barnet being built in the parking lot, and on and on. So they do have a bit of a track record with taking riverfront properties in Garden City and redeveloping them. So we're going to see where this all goes. We've, between Margaret and I, covered lots of stadiums since 2018. We'll keep watching this for you. But yeah, we could see two pro soccer teams come to Boise and potentially a rejuvenated Boise Hawks. And I think a lot of people would be excited to see that.
Oh, I think so. Well, we're going to keep our eye on it, but I'm not holding my breath. All right, it's Friday, which means football. Lots of football to talk about. And we are lucky enough to have Jay Tust, reporter and sports director at KTVB with us today to give us an update. Jay, great to have you back on the show.
Great to be back. And first off, happy game day.
I know. Happy game day. Big stuff going on for the Broncos. So before we get into game day itself, now, unless maybe you've been living under a rock, which some people do, there is a phenomenal player on the Broncos who is getting so much national attention. I'm talking about Ashton Jeanty. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he is a phenomenal human, a phenomenal player, a great teammate, and I believe just truly a unique athlete in today's world where it's all about me, 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 and I, and all that stuff, right? Ashton is the first person to deflect praise back to his teammates, his coaches, despite the fact he has earned a lot of that praise. He leads all of college football in rushing yards by a wide margin. He has been phenomenal this year, and I've been covering this team, this league, for 14 seasons now, believe it or not, and in my time of doing that, Ashton Jeanty is without a doubt the best player that I've seen in the Mountain West Conference, and I think that a lot of people would agree with me too. So he is getting a ton of national praise. He is a Heisman hopeful. Right now he is one of the guys that probably a top four to contend to that for that trophy. And if he stays there, at the very least, he's going to be in New York that first weekend of December with a chance to win it. And that's just kind of, you know, the only other person that's made it that far is Kellen Moore, and he did it once. And so Ashton's kind of entered that territory, which I think speaks volumes of how good he is.
So, Jay, talk about, too, kind of what I was learning about him as well is that all of these professional athletes on these podcasts and everything have been talking about how he positions himself on the field. They're like, we've never seen anything like it. He just stands there and then does these, like, you know, you see him, like, jumping over people. I mean, it's incredible to watch.
Yeah, he's become a meme for sure, or a GIF or anything else that – you know, for that matter, I think it's amazing. I mean, it's the Kelsey brothers, it's George Kittle, yes. Debo Samuels. I mean, it's a lot of really, really talented NFL players that are recognizing him right now, and he's still in college. And so recently we asked him about that, and, you know, he says it's incredibly cool to hear people like that talking about him. As far as his stance goes, he really doesn't have a crazy great explanation for it. He said that, you know, at one point in time, one of his coaches, when he was a little bit younger, said that you should be comfortable when you're in the backfield and you should be able to stand in that position for as long as you need to. So he's just kind of bought into that, and he feels comfortable standing very upright with his arms like locked down to his side almost. It's not necessarily an athletic position, which you feel like you would want to be in as a running back, but who's going to question this guy at this point, considering how amazing he's played? And the funny thing about this is that now you're seeing, you know, it could be local high school kids mimicking him. There was even a guy in the NFL last week that was noticeably standing more upright than he has stood in the past. So you wonder if he's taking a page from Ashton Jeanty's playbook. But he's not just the talk of college football. He's earning his way into, you know, what's going on in the NFL in mainstream media. And so it's been really, really cool to see him kind of just explode. And he's so deserving of it. He is so deserving of it.
You know, what's interesting to me as well, I saw a clip of an interview that he was giving, and he was asked the question, like, why Boise State? You know, why are you staying with the blue turf? Of course, there's never any love, it seems, for Boise State Broncos outside of the Treasure Valley. But with that said, you know, he talked about the fact that, you know, he acknowledged, look, I could have gone into the college portal, but it's my coach and it's my teammates. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, Jay, that I think that's so telling about his character off the field.
You're exactly right. And when Spencer Danielson was named the head coach last year, I mean, that was like basically the thing that sold Ashton. Like that was the reason he wanted to come back. He wanted to come back and play for Spencer Danielson, and they are very, very close. And, you know, the thing about Ashton is that he's kind of got a military background. You know, his dad was in the military. He spent time overseas. He is a very loyal human. Like he just is. And he wasn't distracted by all the money and stuff that was probably being dangled in front of his eyes in the transfer portal You know, people illegally probably direct messaging him on Twitter or Instagram or wherever, trying to get him to leave Boise State to go there. He was very focused, and you know, he wants to create a legacy, and he's absolutely doing that. Whenever his playing career is done at Boise State, and let's face it, the way he's playing, he's going to be off to the NFL by the end of this year. He is going to create something that is going to be very, very hard to mimic. And, you know, Ashton, another cool story that I'll tell for you that I haven't even gotten the chance to get on Bronco Roundup Game Day and share yet. He, I think this speaks to his character too. So he loves to cook. And during the summer, he would always cook for his roommates. He lives with Andrew Simpson, a star linebacker for Boise State, as well as Zion Washington, who's a guy that's really emerged on the Boise State defense this year. And he would cook them dinner almost every night. They would wake up in the morning, and he would let his roommates know if there was a rare occasion where, hey, guys, I'm not making food tonight, you're on your own. But for the most part, he would cook for them every night. And the way that one of his roommates described it to me is it was be like 6 o'clock and they'd run down the stairs like little kids, and their Ashton is, you know, with food ready to go for them to eat. So it just, he'd go out and buy it. He'd take care of it and everything. Wow. And he would, you know, break bread with his teammates and whatnot. And I just think that's a cute little story that shows like how much he truly cares about his friends, his teammates, and Boise State.
And you know what? It is showing when you look at the Broncos' performance, right? Not only is he creating a legacy, but Jay, talked to us about the Broncos themselves. I mean, it's game day today, but man, they are up in the AP poll, and it is really, this is an exciting season.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the most exciting season in maybe a decade for the Boise State football team. You have to go back to 2014, the last time they played in a Fiesta Bowl, which is, you know, just kind of the pinnacle of what this program has climbed to. They're 3-0 in the Fiesta Bowl, but this team now is in position to maybe do something that they've never done, and that is contend for a national championship. Right now, with the expansion of the college football playoff to 12 teams, Boise State is in the driver's seat to make it out of the group of five. And if they just continue to do what they do, you know, come early December when the selection show happens, Boise State is going to be a part of that. And that just means that they will have their foot in the door to where if they win a few games, they're going to be playing in a national championship. And, you know, it's crazy that it's not crazy to think that it's actually a possibility. When you have Ashton Jeanthi, to be honest with you, he's the best player in college football, and anything is possible. And so right now they are you know, on the path towards, you know, arguably, it's crazy to say this, but it could be the best season in Boise State football history if they make the college football playoff and go on a run.
Okay, I literally just got chills, Jay, because I think back to when I'm going to date myself. I'm going to back to when I moved here 25 plus years ago. And when you see the history of this team, right? And they were kind of like just this little hometown team. And then you see that progression. And I think that those of us who have been here for a long time, and someone like you who has not just followed the team, but you have reported on them. I mean, you know this, you know, this program. I think that we always hoped that they could be in this position. And I think that we kind of always knew that there was that possibility. But now it's really possible.
It is. And like I said a moment ago, it's wild to think that you can say that Boise State could have the best season they've ever had in program history. But that really is what this team is staring at right now. And I think what's even crazier is about a year ago, this was when the 2013 season really kind of started to unravel. Jeremiah Dickey, the director of athletics, made a very difficult call to fire the head football coach and move in a different direction. He then made another bold move by, you know, naming Spencer Danielson, who in the coaching ranks is very young. He named him the interim head coach, and Boise State finished that season strong, winning a Mountain West Conference championship, and they went to a bowl game. And then, you know, somewhere along the line, Jeremiah Dickey named Spencer Danielson the head coach. And, you know, a year ago, almost to the week, it felt like this was a lost program. And I asked Spencer Danielson about it a little bit this week. What's the difference? Because largely they have the same players. They almost have the exact same entire coaching staff. Really, the only thing that is a significant difference is the man that stands behind the podium at Monday press conferences. Mm-hmm. And now that's Spencer Danielson. He says that it's not about him, it's about his players, but that's really nice of him, but clearly he has made a massive, massive difference. Yeah. And now he has this program on the cusp of a historic season.
Well, Jay, and I think this might have been video from you, actually, when that announcement came last year, when they named Spencer Danielson, and when he told the team, I've never seen a group of athletes jump up and be as excited as they were for that announcement.
They love him. Like, they love him. And that is such an important, you know, it can be overlooked, but it's such an important thing when it comes to sports. Playing, it sounds cliche, but playing for the person to your left, playing for the person to your right, or playing to the person that addresses you in a team meeting every single day. And these guys are willing to run through a wall for Spencer Danielson. And they said that time and time again. And the cool thing about last week's game, it was back down at UNLV, the place mm-hmm. where Boise State won a Mountain West Conference championship a year ago. And there was still some uncertainty of whether or not Spencer Danielson would get the full-time position. And after Boise State won that game, all the players, in every media availability they had, made sure that Jeremiah Dickey knew they wanted Spencer Danielson to be their head coach. One day later, Jeremiah Dickey named Spencer Danielson the head coach of the Boise State football team. But going back there last week, there was almost a little bit of a rush of emotions that was unexpected on my part. Mm. But kind of walking into that place, I'm like, man, this program was in turmoil last year, and now they're in position to go to the college football playoff a year later. And talking with Alexander Tubner, one of their star defensive backs, he said he spoke to the team last week, and he kind of relayed like what he said, and it was more or less saying that, you know, they said that they were going to do everything they could to play as hard as they could for Spencer Danielson last year, and those emotions and those feelings have not wavered despite the fact that they've kind of become a little bit more routine, I would say. And so they're still playing for him, and they want to do something that this program has never done, and that is to go to the college football playoff.
Okay, and it's game day today. So who are they playing?
San Diego State, who, you know, they're not having a great season, but they are kind of a sneaky team. I think they figured it out just a little bit. They've played a lot of close games lately. They, too, have a first-year head coach in Sean Lewis, who actually showed some interest in the Boise State job when that came open last year. He wound up at San Diego State. And San Diego native Spencer Danielson is the head coach at Boise State. Mm. So there are some connections there for sure. And they have the best pass rusher in the country in Trey White, despite the fact Boise State has the best pass rush in the country, leading it with 35 team sacks. It'll be a good game tonight, but I am fully expecting Boise State to continue to do what they've done, stay focused, take care of business, and move on to the next one.
Okay, and before I let you go, we've got high school football playoffs starting tonight. Are there any particular teams folks should be looking at?
Yeah, Timberline has had such a magical little season. So inspired by their performance this year. You know, the Wolves won like one combined game over the previous 2 years combined, and they've won six games this year, and they're back in the state playoffs. And they had an epic win last week over Owyhee, going for two at the end of the game for a walk-off win, beating the Storm 35-34. They're just a really cool, fun story. Love what Ian Smart, a former Boise State football player, has done over there. Outside of that, Rocky Mountain remains the team to beat. They played Eagle in the 6A SIC championship game last week and blew out the Mustangs 38-0. Now, Eagle's got a good squad, but right now Rocky's just a cut above. Both those teams have byes next week. They'll return to action next week, and it'll be fun to watch.
All right. Well, as always, Jay, we so appreciate you taking time to talk with us, and really appreciate it. So thanks so much.
You bet.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.